This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 30. And I want to thank you for listening. And I also want to apologize for the little break that we've had. I just have had a lot going on. I've had some surgery. And I also had to get a journal article final edits done, which I got some good news on, but I'll tell you about that in a later episode. Anyway, but I'm back on track. Lots of content coming. Lots of great guests lined up. And we have a special guest on this episode, Los Angeles-based Ali Borden. I've been wanting to talk to her for a while, and we cover a wide range of topics, including anorexia, addiction, doing postmodern therapy in treatment centers, and self-care and sustainability of us therapists. So I think you'll really enjoy this episode. You're not going to want to miss it. But before we get there, just a couple of quick announcements. A YouTube channel has launched, a Radical Therapist YouTube channel. If you have not seen it yet, please go check it out. Go subscribe, like it, share the videos. And if you're a teacher, you might even be able to use some of them as a teaching tool. At least I'm going to promote it that way. But there's several videos up now. Lots of different topics, more coming. Just go to search my name, Chris Hoff, H-O-F-F, The Radical Therapist. It should come up. If not, just go to the Radical Therapist website, theradicaltherapist.com, and you'll be able to access the YouTube channel through there. And please go check it out. And yeah, that's the big news. And I got a couple of announcements. I'm doing this a week before the Los Angeles Postmodern Therapy Conference at USC. It's on April 9th, Sunday, April 9th. I think it's sold out, but it might not be. So you might want to check it out. Just go to Facebook, search POMO Therapist, P-O-M-O Therapist, and reach out that way to Kathy Adams. And I'm sure if there's room, she'll find a way to get you in. Also, if you want to come hang out with me, I'm going to be at a couple places this summer. The first one's going to be at the AFTA conference in Philadelphia, the American Family Therapy Academy conference in Philadelphia. And that's going to take place on May 31st through June 3rd. Always a good time. Lots of great content. Speakers, presentations, all of that. And actually, I've never been to Philadelphia, so I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm also very excited. This will be my first excursion to Peggy Sachs's Narrative Camp in Vermont. And this is taking place in June. We have June 12th through the 13th. Let me tell you who's going to be there. That'll be the workshop with, I think that's David Parry, Lynn Rosen, and Ian Percy, where they're doing extending the histories of narrative practice, creating spaces for emerging approaches. And shortly following that, on June 15th, is the workshop with David Epstein and Tom Carlson, Insider Witness Practices, Performing Hope and Beauty in Narrative Therapy. So that's basically a week of great learning available, and I will be there, so come hang out with me. And if you want information on that, go to reauthoringteaching.com, and I'll try to make sure I have these in the show notes so you can access those. So those are a couple conferences. I told you about the YouTube channel. I have t-shirts now. If you would like a Radical Therapist t-shirt, just go to if you want to see what they look like, go to the Instagram site at The Radical Therapist. Just search The Radical Therapist on Instagram, and you can see several people modeling the shirt, and also stickers. If you want Radical Therapist stickers, just shoot me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. For the shirt, I might make you do something like get a friend to subscribe to the YouTube channel, or write a review on iTunes for the show, and I'll send you out a shirt. I think they're pretty cool. So at least everybody looks at me when I'm wearing them. Funny. I think it's a good thing. So those are available. So go check that out. So I think that's all the news I have for you. So hopefully we'll see you at somewhere this summer. at one of those conferences. That would be nice. But anyway, and always please reach out to me for feedback on the shows or for stickers or for what have you. I love getting fan emails. So please keep that up. So, well, let's get to the show. Like I said, we cover a lot of topics and it's great. And I think you're going to get a lot out of it. And I've been wanting to talk to Allie for a long time. For those that don't know, Allie Borden's a longtime postmodern therapist, narrative therapist based in Los Angeles. She's been working in the field for over 15 years and sees lots of different folks for lots of different wide range of different problems. And she's really interested in, well, she speaks and trains therapists and has spoke all over the world. And she loves to help people improve their lives. And she has a particular interest in how to help develop motivation when people are ambivalent about change. And she just has a wealth of experience, knowledge, and as you'll find out when we talk to her. So why don't we not wait any longer and let's go chat with Allie. All right. Welcome to the show, Allie.
Hi, Chris. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm awesome. I just think it's wonderful. I know we've been trying to connect for a little bit, and I'm glad we got the time. And I'm just really excited to have this conversation. I've been a fan of your work since I got introduced to it, and I've been able to see you give presentations that were really wonderful. And now I get a chance to kind of sit with and talk with you about the work you're doing, kind of where you've been, what you're doing now, and how you're thinking about the future. And I'm really excited about you making the time for me to do that. So,
oh, it's my pleasure. Yeah. I'm super honored to be asked. You got some heavyweights on this show. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. So, and we're just adding another one. So here. So I guess I want to start just kind of maybe asking a little bit about your professional history. I don't know a lot about your personal history. What brought you to postmodern feminist ideas and therapy, and kind of how you found your way there?
Let's see. I can go way back, which is that my family, I come from a family that has a huge value on social justice. My parents were in the Peace Corps before I was born, and civil disobedience was a matter of course in my family. You know, my stepdad was arrested for chaining himself to a tree when the streets were going to be widened in the neighborhood. And that was, you know, folklore in my family. So no nukes and trips to Africa and Nicaragua were just a matter of course. And the feminist movement had a lot of, you know, a lot of voice in my house. My mom was a feminist and taught me very early on, you know, don't be dependent on a man, have your own vote, your own checkbook and your own orgasms. Like, it was all very, women should be equal to men, and you have a right to have your own experience. So from very early on, I feel like my family was aware of systems in the world that disenfranchised people and that people didn't all get the same leg up as everybody else, and that it was our job to help people with that, that we had a certain amount of privilege. We weren't rich or anything, but that we had a lot more privilege than a lot of people, and that it was our job to help people. So a lot of the white kids in my neighborhood were bused and taken to private schools. And my folks were like, nope, you're going to stay here in the public school. There's things that you get from diversity and from community that you can't get by getting in the smaller white schools. And I also feel like they didn't want to do that to the community. Like, they didn't want to split the neighborhood and be part of white flight. So from very early on, I feel like social responsibility and protest was really just something that was in my veins. At the same time, I grew up in this culture where there were all kinds of discourses about what a good woman should be, you know, and they were, I wasn't immune to those discourses despite a counter narrative of feminism. I had the, you know, I went through public schools where I was, you know, it was just in the water about don't take up too much space, apologize for yourself, you know, don't be too selfish, attend to the needs of others. You know, all of that, you know, and my, for certain, I was, very connected to the idea that my value was in relationship to whether I was attractive or chosen by men. So, I think that I didn't quite know what to do at the time, with any other experiences that I might've had that didn't fit within that model. It didn't allow me to go to my own experience and think about what I might have wanted. Certainly, you know, the fact that I was attracted to women and men had no place in that model. And so I feel like I tried really hard to fit myself into boxes for a long time, amputating parts of myself. And, you know, the way that we think about women who have eating problems is that they're comparing themselves to magazines, that the problems have been reduced to, you know, just the body. But I feel like the body is a side point, that we're all trying to fit ourselves into smaller categories and not go outside the lines and measure ourselves against whatever standards there are in culture that say you should who you should be. So I have a history of trying to invisibilize myself and amputate parts of myself. And then I feel like when I ran into postmodernism and social constructionism, they brought forward the story of protest and social justice. And I was like, oh yeah, this is me. You know, these ideas helped me to feel like it was okay to be able to attend to desires and appetites and who else I might be besides who I was, felt like I was trying to approximate. So Janella Bird speaks really eloquently to the fact that when traits are internalized, it invisibilizes the structures that are sort of pushing on us all the time, and that some people are made to feel more confident and more entitled to their choices. And some choices are much more socially supported than other choices. They're easier to make because they're in the lane that people want, you know, that the world is saying is an okay lane. So it's not the same project, it feels like, for someone to express desires that are socially acceptable for the helping someone express desires that are outside of that lane. So some people are supported in wanting things and other people are seen as deviant, and that's a really tough thing. And yet we internalize it and go, oh, that person's confident. And so the fact that we'd actually be able to go, what supported you in your life to feel that confidence, you know, not just what things in your family potentially, but what things have made you feel entitled. You know, friend Lita Brewer has this great anecdote about, like, you know, the middle class white guy wakes up in the morning thinking the world's my oyster. And, you know, a person of color wakes up in the morning and thinks, how am I going to like garner my courage today to be in this world and hold on to myself in the face of, you know, a world that's telling me that I'm not good enough and that I maybe don't even belong in this country. You know, like, it feels like the Western world is so enormously powerful at limiting choices, and that it feels like therapy has gotten in line with that in so many ways in terms of setting up norms and things that we ought to be, whether it's like having good boundaries or having the right kind of relationship or sex in the right way or even, you know, being the right gender. And that we have a long history of recruiting people into projects of normalization and limiting those options. And I would love to be part of a, you know, you can see how these ideas, postmodern ideas and social constructionist ideas, were immediately resonant for me, because I could see it with my own different discourses in my life, how things get shut off and narrowed, and that these ideas were really, feel like they were supported practices and ways of being in the world that allowed for lots of ways of being and putting choices back on the menu that are sometimes difficult to make, and didn't internalize the fact that it didn't make me at fault for the fact that they were difficult to make. I have this metaphor that I use with clients all the time, which is, it's if I decided that I wanted today that clothes were too constraining and that I wanted to leave the house and just decided I wanted to be where, you know, not wear any clothes, I was going to be a nudist today. The world isn't going to celebrate my choice in that. <I know. Nope. laughs> There's going to be lots of effects of that. And in fact, the choice about whether wearing clothes or not each day has been taken off the menu. Like, if you think about it, you don't wake up and think whether you're going to get dressed or not. You right. think, yeah. What am I going to wear? It's like I'm not even arguing for public nudity. I'm just arguing for the fact that choices have been limited. And we think that they're all available, but we've been so narrowed. And I just feel like it's my job as a therapist to open up doors of possibility and put things back on the table and make choices that at one point were unthinkable. So all of that feels like it is how I came to these ideas. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I love that. And And early on, you got involved in a book project with David Epstein, and I'm wondering how that happened or how that came to be. And just so the listeners know, just in case, the book is Biting the Hand That Starves You, Inspiring Resistance to Anorexia and Bulimia. How did that project come about?
Well, you can tell why narrative language fit with me and the values that I had from, you know, as soon as I came across it. My first class actually was with David Marston, and in school, you know, you go through your graduate program. And
where did you go to school?
I went to school at Antioch University, and you know, as I was going through it, I feel like I'd listen to different models and think, oh, I can see the world from that lens, even though I wasn't thinking of it that way. I was just like, yeah, that sounds true. And ultimately, when I got in my first narrative class, I felt like, oh my gosh, this. It was like the choir, the heavens opened up and sing, you know, I could hear singing where I was like, oh my gosh, this takes into account the social forces that I've been trying to name. And it also really mapped to my experience of being sort of buffeted around by other forces, that it wasn't just an internal decision, and that identity wasn't just an individual project either. So I felt like, you know, at that time, working with David, I immediately started to get into the narrative community and working with all kinds of people that I could. So when David and Rick approached me with, the authors of Biting the Hand, they started sending me transcripts of sessions, and I soaked them up like a sponge initially. Like, I was just like, it's so nice to hear people talk about these discourses in really unique ways. So I ultimately started to consult with them, on what I thought was important to be included in the book, from the perspective of someone who was subject to the discourses in a way that neither of them were, as two white men. It feels like I was able to speak to both as a woman who'd been subject to these ideas and, you know, live in the world of patriarchy, and as a student of narrative therapy and therapist of narrative therapy, to be able to go, oh, here's the ideas that are super helpful to me in liberating people. So And in terms of that problem, the problem of anorexia, I don't think it's any accident that Michael White and David Epstein cut their teeth on the problem of anorexia. If you go back and look at their really early work, it feels like that you can look at the effects of that problem as mirroring that of if we think of the panopticon, and that how do we identify people and categorize them and engage them in projects of self-surveillance and self-policing and comparison and then self-improvement. It feels like that's the perfect metaphor for the way that that problems work. It just happens to be like sort of a version that's laid bare where people are doing it in particular on their bodies. But it feels like it's such a great model for every problem about how we're constantly adapting ourselves and trying to fit ourselves into things. And so I feel like it was great work to start me in this profession, because I feel like anorexia is such a tough problem that I feel like I sort of joke that it's like learning to drive on a stick, that you can drive every car because it feels like it's so pernicious and difficult and yet so transparent. So I feel like that, and you know, is what started me in the work and really got me interested in these ideas. And that's basically the answer to that question.
Yeah. And so I think you then ended up, you ran treatment centers for many years, or you kind of worked in the treatment world. And I'm wondering how you got involved in that work.
Well, you know, private practice, when I first started in this work, private practice seemed so kind of private.
That was my experience.
It's so in a room between you and one person, and I think really moving conversations can be happen that way. But I'm someone who does well with people and community. You know, I've had some really challenging times in my own life, and I feel like my life has been saved by rooms full of people that have been very, very useful to me. And so I feel like I thought that treatment centers provided a possibility for people to actually have communities, that groups provided a place for people to actually be able to have conversations and perform identity and come to be known in a way that individual one-on-one work doesn't really provide. So that, and I also love working with other practitioners. You know, it's one of the reasons I love supervision and consultation, is that I feel like it's the connection with other practitioners and trying to hold on to these ideas is it sustains the work. You know, as Vicki Reynolds would say, you know, I think we shoulder each other up. And so the fact that we would work in a community and that clients would be having conversations in a community feels like it just provided a lot of possibility at that time that individual work didn't provide. I also think, you know, I am in private practice and I do private work. And I feel like I look for ways to broaden the room, you know, to take therapy outside of the room, whether that's working on issues that aren't just about insight or whether that's bringing in other relationships into the room. Mm-hmm. I think treatment centers or group work feels like it just offers that so much more. It's just readily available. And I think that we get, you know, traditional therapy has identity as an individual project, that it's something that we do between ourselves and ourselves, you know, and that right. I feel like that it's offensive to me that we think that we can just have conversations with people and change the way that they think and that they'll go out and be able to be that way in the world. I just think that we're held by the communities that we're in and that we want to be reflected by the people that know us. And I personally don't want to be the only person in somebody's life. I think sometimes I might be, and I might have to be for a time, but I feel like my goal is to help people be in connection with others and be seen for the things they want to be seen for, and being able to act out the things that they value in the world. So treatment centers as group centers basically felt like they were super useful about that. Now, they're tricky because, you know, trying to hold on to alternative ideas in a treatment center world that's primarily, you know, that's propped up by traditional medicalized notions and, you know, ideas about health and wellness or sickness and wellness that is super standardized, that can be super challenging. So I got concerned about how treatment centers were being used as colonizing mechanisms instead of community building mechanisms. And that in the worst case, I think that they recapitulate experiences of inadequacy and people getting their needs blown by or their own experiences blown by in the first case, you know, that people are, I think Helen Mallison did a lot of this work and Helen Gramillion's done a lot of this work, which has to do with like how the treatment center sets up a new norm. Okay, so you're no longer trying to approximate anorexia standards. Now you're trying to approximate mental health standards of who you ought to be, you know, and that there's comparison and evaluation and all that, you know, attempt to perfect oneself in relationship to these standardized norms. And I think that is super problematic. And then I said, what was the second one that I said?
Well, I was going to wonder on this topic, actually, you know, how has the challenge been bringing these kind of postmodern ideas into these centers for you? Mm-hmm. What has been the struggle?
Well, when I went to, when I first started to do this, I felt like individual work was not going to be enough for me, that I wanted to help clinicians and I wanted to help clients in more public settings. I really did a deep, deep dive in training to figure out how to incorporate these ideas in a treatment center. It's not that easy. You know, it's funded by insurance and sure. Again, traditional models of health are just taken for granted by clients, parents, insurance companies, therapists. Like, it's a wind tunnel of assumptions that it's very hard to find your own way in. But I took a year-long training with Michael White just the year before he died, and I went to New Zealand and studied with Janella Bird. I went to Peak House and saw what they were doing in Vancouver. I did a lot of work with Larry Zucker about how to bring postmodern ideas into the structure of a treatment center. And at the time, I'll be honest, I felt like a bit of a outsider in the POMO community because I think I was not that I was worried that much about how I was seen, but my sense is that how do I say this?
Like you were crossing over into enemy lines or something?
Yeah, I was working for the enemy, you know, like all of a sudden it felt like, oh, like, you know, treatment centers are bad places that colonize people's identity. And I don't disagree, you know, that they can be places where people get their identities singularly identified and then immediately get set up for all kinds of assumptions based on that. But I feel like Barbara Meyerhoff's work about, you know, reflecting teams and being in community is our work. And there's ways to make groups do that. And that sitting in private practice and not really trying to remake the structures of the systems that are out there felt like it was avoiding the struggle. So I really felt like when I had the chance to, you know, was offered a chance to be a clinical director of a program, and I remember fighting diligently for, like, it has to be able to be my program. It has to be able to have my ideas in it. I get that we still have to have insurance funding, but I want to run the groups the way that I want to run them. I want to change the systems so that the different conversations are taking place. And I feel like, you know, I really fought hard for what kinds of things can we do differently? What kinds of ways can we bring forward different kinds of identity, different or different stories about identity and different names for the problem, and you know, like, just open up the possibilities all over the place. So that's how I ended up in it. I think my job, my idea was, how could we reappropriate treatment centers that have been used by therapists and the therapy system as one more method of colonization? How could we, you know, take those back and actually use them for the desires of the people, you know, and really help people be known as broader and provide a variety of services to people, not just a single service that is our job here is to get you from what we determine as unhealthy to what we suddenly determine as healthy. Some of my concerns is that we as a therapy industry feel like now it's just the brave march of knowledge, and you know, yeah, and we're closer to science, and we're away from culturally defined problems. You know, now that homosexuality is out of the DSM, we think, oh, now we've got it, and everything that's in there is actually objective and real, and yeah, not just a culturally informed bias. And I think that those are dangerous assumptions.
Sure. So. You're now part of a new project that I heard about and kind of found out about, that you're consulting with Evo Health and Wellness, which is kind of this different, you're doing something differently in support of people struggling with substances. Can you say a little bit more about that and how you view, or how the problems of maybe anorexia or addiction are similar or different, and how you're looking at these things?
Sure. Well, I think what people are up against is complex. And I think that people are, you know, as I've said already, I feel like the world dispenses of feelings of inadequacy that that people's responses are understandable in those contexts, that both dieting and drinking are first on the list of cultural offerings to how to respond when you're feeling bad about yourself. You know, and they load in certain ideas of not just as like traditional ideas of self-soothing, but they load in all kinds of ideas about identity. You know, like we go, oh, now I'll be special and desirable and have confidence, and that there's a certain amount of moral worth that's granted for those problems, you know, by responding in that way, which makes them particularly pernicious and tricky to get out from underneath. And I think if treatment centers are narrow into just behavior reduction, they miss the fact that this is an issue around identity and worth and value and connection. And so one of the things that Evo Health and Wellness is really trying to do is make responses to problems bigger. More than half the program that they're developing, I'm just consulting, but they've got some really great ideas over there, and more than half their program is based on case management. It's including, you know, job support or schooling support or housing or connections or what are your other interests besides this. Like there's conversations, therapeutic conversations about how things get in the way and what you're trying for and your intentions. But there's also a heavy weight of the fact that this is about community and being seen for other things and who else you are. And what if you have a conversation in here, what difference is it going to make out there? What would be different in your life out there if this turns out to do what you want it to do? So it feels like it's a alternative program that's really trying to see things outside of the traditional model of this is insight. I think most treatment centers have this idea that you should just be able to have this aha moment, you know, that you should be able to arrive at some fixed ending with a problem, as opposed to the fact that it's A, in a context that feels like we need to negotiate, and B, it's going to be a lifetime of negotiating different things. Sure. And so I don't think people need to stay in treatment until they're better. They just need to have access to get access to certain parts of themselves and continue to relate in the world.
Yes. So how are you thinking now about the concept of addiction or even AA, abstinence, recovery? How are you thinking about these things?
Let's see. Well, I think oppression is what's making people's lives hard. And that we live in a world that's making it difficult, whether it's patriarchy or classism or homophobia or all kinds of isms that feel like they're making life hard. It feels like substances don't kill people. Oppression kills people, and substances become a reasonable response to oppression. So in that sense, I feel like it's back to like what I was mentioning about what Eva was doing, is really trying to see the problem in a broader context. That being said, you know, addiction is such a complicated word because it feels like it's a medicalized word. It invokes all kinds of certain assumptions about what has to happen and where someone needs to go. And AA is such a dominant model these days, and abstinence, as it's associated with that, feels like it's the rule of law, and that genetics has filtered into that. Once the genetics discourse got so strong, it felt like it just supported the abstinence. Well, you have this gene, so you're not going to be able to drink within moderation or use within moderation or use any substances for that matter, depending on how strong the lane of AA, different AA groups see it different ways.
Sure,
but
sure.
I feel like we're in relationship to our bodies in a multitude of different ways. You know, we eat, we drink, you can meditate, you can masturbate, you can buy things, watch a romantic movie, and you've input something that's changed the way that you feel. So I feel like we can't separate substances as the only thing that we do to our body. And I feel like I want to encourage people to be in relationship to their bodies and notice the different effects of different things on their bodies. And again, all of those effects are not disconnected from the cultural meaning behind it. You know, we're having a bio response, but we're also having a response based on what it actually means that I'm doing this thing. So I feel like it's so complicated to think about addiction as just a gene problem or a cellular problem that needs to be handled
brain problem.
Yeah, or a brain problem. It needs to be handled by a single intervention or a single destination. And so I feel like I think that, you know, I have very close friends who describe AA as saving their life. And so I feel like our job is to be with clients where they are. My first question is always to a client, what do you think about it? And not like, when my ideas about it are secondary. And I think whether someone finds it useful or not, my questioning is going to be around making sure that there's just possibilities. There's more than one way to treat this. That's an okay way. If that was on the menu of choices, you know, and there were many things on the menus of choices, then it's a great thing to have on the menu. If it's the only item on the menu, then I feel like that's problematic. And right now, it can be the singular solution, and it's pulled into court. You know, the court refers people to it, and
sure.
That I think that narrows people's options. But as a community of people, I feel like the fact that you have a place where, no matter how much you slip, where we're you don't have to, you can name the things that you're not that proud of, and we're still going to love you here. And people are available at any time of the day. And that's a pretty great sense of community, back to
sure.
community, that a lot of problems don't have. And AA is available out there. So I feel like I can work with clients in other models and say, let's make space for there to be other alternatives than the main loud discourse on the block, or working within that model and who do you want to be in relationship with, and what kinds of conversations would you have to have with other people individually that would help them see you and make space for you to and your own ideas in the relationships that you have there. Like, I don't think you have to divorce the system.
No.
You know, the one of the mottos is take what you need and leave the rest. So it feels like I feel like that's I'd love to help people have that motto in lots of, in every area of their life.
Sure.
So,
okay. So, as I understand it, you are doing consulting for program development for treatment centers. How are you helping them to be this kind of work more this way, or be more collaborative? And do you see this as political work? And
I think this is political work. I think, as you can tell, I think conversations are political actions, and that the meanings that we take up have long-reaching effects. So, when I consult with treatment centers, my goal is to help them find ways to be more collaborative. I think, collaborative is thrown around all the time now, and everybody wants to be collaborative. And I think mostly people end up, what they mean by that is a multitude of methods heading towards a singular solution. And I actually think that the solution has to be questioned, that assuming what we have to get you to is abstinence, and I can be collaborative on the way that I get you there. You know, we can use CBT, DBT, or, EMDR, feels like it's different than, wait, where are we headed? So, and you know, what's important to people, and are we reducing them to problems, singular definitions of problems, versus how we might come to understand what's getting in the way in their life, that the substances or whatever the problem that they present with is in some ways maybe even a distraction. It's too narrow for what's actually going on. So I feel like I'm helping treatment centers find ways to shape groups, entry and exit ceremonies, family sessions. Like, there's all kinds of opportunities there for developing different kinds of conversations that bring forward who else people are. Like, groups don't have to be connections over the problems. Groups can be connections over other similarities. Groups can be like seeing each other's differences. It can mean pulling out of the homogeneity of seeing us all as a certain kind of problem, and instead trying to make space for the diversity, it feels like. So I'm trying to help there be practices and programmatic things brought into individual and group conversations that allow for some of that. When I first started working at a treatment center, they had what they call the life map, which was you came in and you told your history, and there was very little structure around what they asked you to tell your history by. And so generally it was a history of all the bad things that everybody had happened to them. So it's sort of, therapy implies, I want to know what's wrong with you, right?
Sure.
Not what's right with you. Like, right. So if you don't frame the question, people just say, well, this happened to me when I was 5, and this was 8, and this is when the first sign of the problem showed up. And it's a history of oppression, actually, and the way that the problem infiltrated their lives. And I immediately wanted to change that to asking other questions about who people have been and what they valued and who their community is, you know, what their hobbies are and other things that are important to them. You know, what meaningful moments have there been in their lives? And that, from the very beginning, brings forward the identity of someone in an entirely different way than a pathologized, narrow, problem-centered account. And so that's not a huge intervention to change the way that someone asks that question. You don't have to change the whole system to bring forward that. But that is generative. So that conversation meant that clients were connecting around all kinds of different issues, and everything from there forward, it begets so much other possibilities that a narrow, negativized, medicalized story doesn't allow for. So I feel like I'm trying to help treatment centers add more of those practices in their repertoire.
That's great. So how are you thinking about how these clients you're working with or consulting for, how their relationship to the problem evolves over time, and what kind of support might be needed? As time goes on, and or various times of their lives?
Yeah, I think people need different kinds of support at different times. I think we think of treatment as something, as soon as you see the problem at all, even a glimmer of it, then you have the diagnosis and it must be treated, as opposed to seeing it as some information. And I see people in my practice all the time who have ongoing relationships with the problem. The evidence of it doesn't mean that someone's being overwhelmed by it. So I feel like treatment might be useful for people if they're being overwhelmed by a problem, particularly if they're medically compromised. Or it might be useful for people if they are in such a state where they're like, I know what I want, but I can't seem to act on it on my own. And so I need a community of people to stand behind me to do this. So people might go in for shorter periods of time or for different tasks, or right now I'm super lonely and I could use a group of people who were helping me take the steps in my life that I want. And so it feels like at different times, whether people's relationship to the problem changes. So I think we tend to only think treatment is for people who are mesmerized or snowed by their problem. And that actually is problematic because it just sets up power struggles where someone's acting upon someone else to try and get them to see where the problem is a problem. And I think that that's more therapeutic violence in my opinion. I feel like it moves into social control to try to arm wrestle somebody outside of their problem.
Sure,
So we have very ethical, we have specific therapist constraints about when we're supposed to intervene, and limits of confidentiality. But they're very specific. We're not supposed to intervene just because someone has a problem. We're supposed to intervene if someone's suicidal and if someone is going to kill someone else or if there's abuse going on. But if somebody's doing something that's not healthy for them, they're smoking, we don't think, oh, it's our job to solve that person's problem, actually. But somehow with both addiction and eating disorders and lots of problems, we think, oh no, this isn't good for them, so it's my job to convince them that they shouldn't have it. And so I think that's a different stage of the problem. You know, talking with someone, making visible how a problem might be affecting their life is a slower process than jumping into treatment. And that, you know, immediately saying, I'm going to arm wrestle you to the ground, you know, and confront you and talk you out of your problem. And so I just think that different people and clients are the authority on what they're needing at certain times. I think there are times when clients are like very choiceful in wanting support and it doesn't feel like a power struggle. It feels like having backup, you know, because I can't hold on to these ideas by myself and identity is not an individualized problem and problems are pernicious. All of those reasons might make someone want to go into a setting where there's a community of people that can help support the things that they're trying to hold on to.
That's great. Okay. Now a little bit about private practice. I know you're doing, you mentioned earlier, you are doing your own private practice. How do these ideas play out in your own practice?
You know, I think our job is seeing clients who are trying to navigate their way in a complicated world, you know, that it's not easy to make certain choices in the world, that and that choices aren't singular. You don't just make a single choice and then all of a sudden you're like, okay, now I'm going to do it. You know, what makes sense one day is harder in different contexts. I feel like if I'm sitting on the beach and someone asked me if I ever want to put on a ball gown again, at that time I would say, yeah, no, I don't see, I might never need to do that again. But then the next time there's actually a ball and everyone else is all dressed up, it might be quite difficult for me to not have to dress up for that or feel like I need to dress up for that. So I feel like conversations with clients about who they want to be and what matters to them and how their story, you know, being really careful about how their story unfolds and what matters to them. And it feels like, and then placing that in relationship to a very complex world is really what I'm trying to help people do is not minimize, well, now that you've decided you want this, why don't you just go out and do it? You know, it's very hard for people to often act on those things. So private practice can allow for slower work, you know, like where you can actually go get into quiet whispers of desires and interests and places that people want to go in the world, that it can be a safe room where people can start to explore or listen to their own feelings in a way. It feels like if we're really present with people and staying out of judgment and out of assumptions, that we really can be close to them and start to put options back on the table and hear those whispers in a way that other places haven't allowed. And that then people can start to hear those, authorize those, figure out what they want to do with those, make complicated decisions about what that means about the relationships they're in. And I feel like that's the work. That's one-on-one work, at least initially. And then it becomes, you know, community work or identity work that's in relationships.
Great. I know you teach, and you did mention earlier doing supervision and liking doing that work. And I'm, how are you doing that work, holding, you know, postmodern assumptions about truth and there not really being any right way? And how are you helping other clinicians kind of, or just teach and help them learn these ways of working?
I think there, one of my main principles is that there's no neutral, you know, that, yeah, that right. we're doing political acts, and that if people imply that they're just being passive receivers, I really want to help talk about how we co-shape meaning with people. That it's our job to do no harm. So I think Michael White has a great quote. I'm going to mangle it, but it's, you know, it's our job to choose from the multitudinous possibilities in any paragraph of conversation, you know, to which threads that we pull on. And so I feel like I work with peers and clinicians and interns to figure out how to go slow and be really careful about what we're pulling on, to negotiate and structure safety with people, you know, to be very, not assume that we have the right to know. I love the work of Vicki Reynolds and Bill Madsen in this area. I feel like both of them have done a lot of work that have to do with getting back to clinicians' preferences about who they want to be. You know, if you ask clinicians who they want to be in the room, they don't go, oh, I feel great when I'm telling clients what to do and they're listening. You know, like, you know, like when you ask clinicians when they feel in the pocket, you know, they're like, oh, I feel in the pocket when I'm present and I'm in a moment and I'm listening to what they say and I'm asking small questions. You know, Larry Zucker has this ophthalmologist idea, better hear, you know, like in these small, very small acts, that I feel like it's, so I try to help clinicians find their way back to those intentions, and then find practices that help them live that out. You know, what makes it possible for you to be present in the room, and what is your North Star? What do you want to be listening for? What do you want to be avoiding? How do we keep assumptions out of the room? So I feel like one of the major things I help interns with is how do you get out of problem solving? Like, it can be so oppressive for clinicians to feel like my job is to make this person better by the end of the hour.
Yeah, right,
and,
right.
you know, that has us doing things that we wouldn't even stand behind. It has us being pushier or coercive or talking too much or those kinds of things, that instead of asking questions because we're feeling pressured by some system or ideal, or some model that of something that if we were doing this right, it would be going faster or better. And so I feel like I'm often trying to encourage therapists to hold those horses back a bit and find ways into being slower and listening for resources and preferences and those kinds of things.
In our clinic, we call it, you know, trying to let go of tying everything up in a nice bow, you know.
Oh, nice. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, okay. So, you are, speaking at the upcoming Los Angeles Postmodern Therapy Conference at USC coming up, and I'm going to be attending that.
And, yeah,
yeah, I'm doing, I'm going to be seeing you. Yeah. Cause it's a really interesting subject to me, especially, you know, just some of the things I'm experiencing in my own life now. And you're taking on a sustainability and self-care and the ethics around that and how to kind of combat or, you know, get some distance from burnout. And, I guess I'm wondering, can you say something about it? Give us a kind of a summary or a preview of what you might be talking about these ideas.
Yes. So I'm speaking at the POMO conference. I'm excited to do it. I think, you know, as a, I'll personally locate myself again as a woman who cares a lot about people and who went into this field wanting to help people, and be with them, and who is subject to all of the don't be selfish discourses. I think it can be challenging for me personally to figure out how to set limits about my usefulness to people. And that all these ideas are, well, you know, if we have all these non-blaming ideas that I love, like externalization and that people culturally and contextually understanding people. And so we know we don't hold people at fault for their problems. So then we're like, well, it's not their fault, so I should help them. So if a person calls me at the end of a, you know, 8-hour day and says, can you squeeze me in tonight? And the only plans I had was, you know, sitting on the couch in front of the TV, I feel like, you know, would a good person take this session? It can be very difficult to say no some of the time without feeling selfish or bad. And I think those of us who are aware of all of the institutional racism and isms that are out there, it feels like we also want to fight this good fight. So it can be very easy to want to take it all on and feel like it's my job to take it on. And I have so much privilege that I should be the one who's out there helping. You know, other people don't have the opportunity to slow down and rest, so I shouldn't either. And I think those are all valid questions. They're not easily answered. You know, I don't mean to imply, oh yeah, we should just validate our own needs and forget the needs of others or whatever. I think that they're complicated because there's two competing things happening at the same time, two competing values, which is I value wanting to help someone and I value needing some downtime. And so I don't think there are very complicated conversations happening about that. And I think Vicki Reynolds does quite a bit of that. And I love that she talks about sustainability and what it needs to be sustainable, and that this is a long haul fight and that it's not, you know, this isn't short work. And so even if you're in a MASH unit, you probably need to sleep between shifts before you go back in and help some more. So I think that I just am interested in helping clinicians figure out how to be in relationship to what can be tough problems and oppressive forces and the desire to help. And all of those are real legitimate things. And also sometimes the need for sleep. And, you know, I love Harlene Anderson's work about being present and withness and slow. And I feel like that work is not done on an empty tank.
Right.
You know, like that you, if I want to be slow and present, I need to be well rested. I want to be able to be there with you and hear the words you say and answer in response to what you just put out there. And I think if I'm under-resourced for a variety of reasons, then I am more likely to be pulling for traditional ideas or what I think I ought to say, or I'm more likely to launch into solution finding than being able to, you know, notice multiplicity and contradictions and, you know, really be able to be with people's suffering as well as their desires about what other kind of life would be. And I think that, I just think that that takes some slowness to it.
That's great.
And, energy.
Thank you for that. So, second to last question. Covered a lot of territory, but I guess I'm curious, like, what ideas currently are you holding most central right now to you personally?
I stand on the shoulders of giants. You know, I love Janella Burr's work. I love her ideas about multiplicity and complexity, you know, and movement over time. And I feel like working with people who don't fit inside the lines, whether that's because of their gender or sexuality or body type or whatever it is, that I really want to be with people in all those contradictions. It's interesting because that last question we talked about where there were just two competing values, I feel like we're often having conversations with people about the fact that they're pulled in many different ways. We don't handle complexity very well in our culture. We just want sort of quick answers blame and responsibility. And so, I love her work about that. I love Alan Wade's work about responses to trauma and that people are always responding. And you know, those dovetail with Michael White's absent but implicit ideas that I feel like that every statement is something that people are for. And even if it's something that they are against, there's an implied something that they're, if you're saying no to something, you're saying yes to something else.
Yep.
So I feel like I that really, really guides me. I love Harlene Anderson's story ball idea, you know, where you're, where we both are making meaning slowly, we're unraveling these fragments together. So I think those are things that guide me. You know, I want people to feel like, whatever their choices are, to be in line with discourses or not in line with discourses are okay, and that we can have conversations about that. I think it's easy to get pulled into that from a postmodern standpoint. We want people to stand up against discourses, but I feel like that's asking a lot of people, and that sometimes being under the radar might be can be a reasonable, maybe temporary, maybe permanent choice for people. And sure. So I think it my idea is really just wanting people to feel like they can be anything, and they can and naming the difficulty that is in relationship to the world. I think we don't want to be where you can be anything, as if, you know, every person can be president. We know that capitalist discourse is a lie, that certain people are privileged in certain ways. But I feel like in this room, you can be anything. And then we have to figure out how you're going to be in relationship to the world and who else you need to support that. I love the ASH study. It always brings me to tears to think about it. But it feels like if you have a room full of Confederates and one person is asked to name a line that's shorter than the other, if everyone in the room names the shorter line as the longer line, they'll capitulate. They'll say the same thing that the group says. Whether they believe it or not, it's hard to know, or whether they just feel like they need to fit in. But if you put one more person in that room who says that shorter line is actually the shorter line, the rest of the person who's in the study will actually also be able to speak for their own intention.
That's wonderful.
That statistically, if we give one person an ally, they're able to stand closer to their own preferences. So I feel like, you know, that's our job as therapists, is to give them a place where someone is understanding what they're for and what they want.
That's great. That's a great way to end. But before I let you go, if people want to reach out to you, Ali, and maybe talk to you or see what you're up to, how would they do that? How would they find you?
You can find me at alliborden.com, and I'm happy to put my phone number in your show notes, and I'm on the POMO list, and like I said, I'm consulting, I'm around, so those are probably the best ways.
And listeners, there'll be links in the show notes for Ali, so you can find her very easily. And I just want to say thank you, Ali, for making the time. This has been a wonderful conversation for me, and I always get inspired. I really appreciate that I just kind of leave these conversations really inspired, and one more time that's happening. So thank you for that.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I was glad to do it.
Yep. Thanks, Ali. Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. Please reach out if you have any questions or would like stickers or t-shirts or what have you at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. That's a quick way to find me. We're all over social media. You can find us on Instagram at theradicaltherapist. We're on Twitter at theradtherapist. Our website is theradicaltherapist.com. And you can find all the shows, both the YouTube channel shows and all the podcast shows, at that site as well. And you can find us on all podcast related places like Podbean and iTunes, etc. So you know, I just really appreciate that you're listening. Please share, you know, if you could take some time, maybe share some of our content to your colleagues, your friends, on your social media. We would really appreciate that. And if you could, we would really appreciate if you would rate and review the show on iTunes. My understanding is that's how we get in front of people. So if you could do that, take a few minutes out of your time to rate and review the show, we would really appreciate that. So as always, thanks for listening. My name is Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist.